Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks. It's the Indie Week. This issue dated July the 20th of 2022, and it's read by John Federson. For a little change of pace, instead of a tedious announcement about who's playing our exciting theme music, I've made just a self-agreement, a vow not to say a single thing about today's theme music and who might be playing it. So you won't hear anything about that, no speculation, no details, nothing about today's music from me, John Federson, your host. But you will hear this issue of Indie Week, starting now. All right, we'll get right into the swing of things with the news from Raleigh by Mariana Fabian called Saving Seaboard Station. Raleigh residents are fighting a proposal that would see the demolition of the historic train station. It has stood as a symbol of the city's past and cultural history for more than 80 years. For Ruth Little, a longtime preservationist and architectural historian, the connection to the historic building is much more personal. She recalls, "When I got married in 1973, we got on the train and went up to New England for our honeymoon. When they found out it was our honeymoon, they actually gave us a private suite on the train. It's always been my train station." Since Robert Logan, Jr. bought the erstwhile train depot and warehouse buildings in 1991, the space has served as a beloved nursery, garden shop, and cafe. In December, the Logans sold that property to New York-based Turnbridge Equities, a real estate and investment company, for $8.5 million. The company's plans for Seaboard Station have some residents alarmed. In a proposal that will soon go before Raleigh's City Council for a vote, Turnbridge plans to demolish the station and replace it with a 12-story parking garage that would serve two 20-story buildings on either side. But in order to construct the buildings, Turnbridge needs the council to approve a rezoning request that changes the cap on building height on the property from 7 stories to 20. The proposal will go to a public hearing in September, ahead of a potential vote. Now, the Seaboard train station held its grand opening in September of 1942 and was used for decades for travel for millions of commuters. When it was first opened, the station saw the departure of many North Carolina soldiers on their way to fight in World War II. It aided travelers until 1986, when CSX Transportation abandoned a stretch of rail from Norlina, North Carolina, to Petersburg, Virginia, and passengers could no longer head north from Raleigh. Up until its closing, Seaboard Station was the only station that served daily long-distance Amtrak trains heading north. Trains were rerouted, and the station sat obsolete and abandoned until the Logan family purchased the station and it became Logan's Trading Company, which is how locals know it best nowadays. The fight to preserve the station has been ongoing. Since Turnbridge purchased the property, Little, the preservationist and owner of Longleaf Historic Resources, says the landmark was never given the historic landmark distinction, which would have protected it from demolition. She says, "Since the 1980s, the Historic Development Commission has been trying, and the state has been trying to list it on the National Register of Historic Places, to make it a local historic landmark because everybody knows how important it is. But it has never happened." Little explains that throughout her travels and research, she's seen historic locations and buildings preserved in unusual ways. She emphasizes that the Seaboard Station can be preserved and utilized for future Raleigh development, and that demolition is not the only option. Frank Harmon, a Raleigh writer, architect, and professor, is critical of the proposed demolition as well and agrees that Seaboard Station is architecturally and historically significant. "In particular," he says, "I like the sheds. They're remarkable. My students have studied them for many years, especially the way the timbers are put together. the economical use of materials, and the thoughtfulness of integrating drainage from rain within the structure. As for its historic significance beyond aiding so many travelers, Harmon points out that Seaboard Station was built during the Jim Crow era and had separate waiting rooms for black and white travelers. There's no trace of that now, he says, but it's a part of Raleigh's history that needs acknowledging. Now, Matthew Brown, North Carolina's former state historian, is an advocate for preserving Seaboard, too. He and other residents had a meeting with Turnbridge Equity's lawyer and a representative, Brown says, in which Turnbridge paid lip service to updated conditions in their proposal that they say will save a part of the station. But Brown says the conditions were drafted in a misleading fashion. Turnbridge representatives did not respond to Indy's request for comment. Brown said, "They give all the conditions about saving this part of the building or that part of the building and so on. However, the building is defined elsewhere as just a section of the building. If they say they're going to save half the building, they really mean half of this part of the building." At the very end, it says, quote, "If we decide not to use any of these options, we'll just tear it down and take pictures of it." That's like saying, "We're going to murder your grandmother, but we'll give her a real nice funeral." Brown says Turnbridge claims that some members of the Raleigh Historic Development Commission, RHDC, approved the demolition of the building. But he says he spoke with the commissioners who said they told Turnbridge that if the company tore the station down, it would have to document the property before the teardown for state archives. That, Brown says, doesn't mean the commission approved of demolishing the station. RHDC members are bound from advocating for or against preservation of an undesignated building. Brown said, "I want to live in a city that's full of interesting buildings that are beautiful architecture, that tell stories that make our lives interesting and beautiful. I don't want to live in a city of cheap, disposable, generic boxes." That sounds like hell to me. Harmon, Little, and Brown all float the idea of turning the station back into what it once was, a station that will serve as a hub for inner-city transportation for Raleigh residents. It's in a prominent location on West Peace Street near William Peace University, plus it still has intact railroad tracks and offers parking, which Raleigh's current Amtrak station lacks. That's for sure. In June, Raleigh's Planning Commission voted to approve that application rezoning as presented. It's an advisory recommendation to the council, but if four or more council members commit to opposing the rezoning, if Turnbridge does not include a condition requiring preservation of the station in some form, the company could have to add such a condition or change its plans for the property. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says it's her understanding, quote, that the conditions have been strengthened to look at preserving the structure and moving it to another site on the property, or preserving pieces and incorporating them into the new design, similar to what was done at the Dillon in Raleigh's warehouse district. In an email, Baldwin says the council will look at these conditions as part of its decision-making. As Seaboard Station stands, a developer could currently build 7 stories there by right and not preserve any of the structure. Baldwin says she would prefer to see some protection of the historic station. 3 other members of the council also told the Indy they don't support demolishing the station. At-large council member Jonathan Melton says he believes Turnbridge should find a way to incorporate the train station into the new development. "I'll be looking at the conditions thoroughly," he says. "I don't think it should be demolished." David Cox of District B supports preserving this landmark and points to the amount of community interest there in saving it. He says, "I don't buy the argument that Seaboard can't be incorporated into their development plans. Unless this developer comes up with a plan, I'm not willing to vote for it as is. If they can't come up with something, maybe another one can." Corey Branch of District C raises some concerns about the development as well as the conditions, but was less certain about his vote. However, Branch says he definitely does not want to see the landmark demolished. Harmon, the architect, notes that in addition to demolishing a landmark and losing a piece of the city's history, tearing down Seaboard Station would just be wasteful. Quote, there's a lot of talk about sustainability. One of the most important ways to do that is to keep the structures that we've had. It goes without saying that the history of that structure is a common history we all share. It's not something that only belongs to that station. That's part of our memory, part of the shape of Raleigh, and part of our future. Why would we even think about tearing something down as valuable as that? Little has enjoyed Seaboard in its latest iteration, long after taking the train to her honeymoon. She's hopeful that the station can be saved. She says, now it's my nursery. It's where I get my bedding plants and my seeds. I go there for lunch with friends. I bought gifts like orchids for people who are sick. It's just been a really big part of my life. Now, interestingly, we have two more articles that are more or less based in Raleigh. And this one, I'm moving over to the online version of IndieWeek called IndieWeek.com, which has a couple of newer articles that weren't included in the publication of the print version. And this one, Downtown Raleigh Alliance Data Points to Economic Rebound. A second quarter market report released by this alliance this week contains positive data on everything from planned developments to the return of beloved festivals like Artsplosure. COVID-19 had detrimental effects on countless businesses and economies, and Raleigh was no exception. In 2020, foot traffic and local business hit an all-time low. But last quarter's numbers reflect on how much work has been done and is yet to be done to get downtown back on its feet. With 17 new development projects underway, residential occupancy at 95%, and a nearly 30% increase in food and beverage sales over the same quarter a year ago, I think it's safe to say Raleigh is in a comeback era. This written by Hannah Kaufman. While not all of downtown has recovered from the pandemic, and many small business owners are still struggling to bounce back from 2 years of lost revenue, the report showed 10 new storefront openings and expansions, says Will Gaskins, the Alliance's Vice President of Economic Development and Planning. Quote, while we continue to see a lot of entrepreneurial activity going on with new or expanding business downtown, and that's just an exciting, continual pace of new local businesses that are opening in downtown. The report highlights how hotel occupancy and tourism shot up from April through June, as well as the success of downtown festivals and major events like Artsplosure, Raleigh Pride, Q Grass, and Brugaloo. Raleigh is also piloting a social district around Fayetteville Street, which will allow people to drink alcoholic beverages as they stroll around downtown. Now, we know about the place, but what about the people? The report showed a 12,000-plus resident population, 48,000 downtown employees, and a median age of 33. The population has doubled since 2010, and it's projected to start approaching 20,000 residents by the year 2026, according to this report. With this increasing population comes new opportunities and jobs. One of the strongest findings in the report was more than 345,000 square feet of net occupied downtown office space from the beginning of 2022 to the end of June, meaning that offices are bouncing back despite the hit they took during the pandemic. The Wall Street Journal recently ranked Raleigh as the third best job market in the United States, and Gaskin says there is much evidence for continued growth going forward. Quote, we're very excited about the prospects of downtown Raleigh overall. The fact we have seen this continued level of interest from the development side of things, from new people moving into the market to leasing apartments and keeping occupancy at a high level, means that there is an extremely robust demand. Raleigh residents' consistent support of local independently owned business is what keeps much of downtown afloat. And the pandemic gave many downtown residents the opportunity to refocus that support towards minority and woman-owned businesses, says Gaskins. End quotes. To see that in a downtown of our size, it's just really encouraging that we prioritize that as a community. Since the start of the pandemic especially, we've really seen an explosion of entrepreneurship and recruitment, relocation, and expansion of minority and women-owned businesses. Back to the print issue now. Jasmine Gallup reports from Wake County about Raleigh and Wake County leaders delivering their own State of the Union address. That's last Thursday. But is the area doing as well as they say it is? The city and county are doing better than ever, according to officials speaking at an annual luncheon on Thursday. Two pillars of politics, Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin and Sig Hutchinson, chair of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, each spoke positively about the progress made in the last year. According to them, city and county officials are leading the charge in making homes and apartments affordable, expanding public transportation, supporting businesses, and reducing gun violence. Baldwin and Hutchinson each have reason to praise Wake County. Under their leadership, the area has seen an incredible economic boom and weathered crises like the COVID pandemic. Baldwin is also up for re-election this fall, giving her a strong incentive to emphasize how well the city is doing. Although Baldwin and Hutchinson have been both active and responsive to issues residents are facing, they've faced their fair share of criticism as well. As scores of people move into Wake County, 62 per day, according to Hutchinson, housing prices have skyrocketed, with demand outweighing supply. The city and county have each set goals for building more affordable housing. That could mean building apartments with rents set lower than market price, so people don't have to spend more than 30% of their income on housing. Or it could mean changing zoning regulations, so it's easier for developers to build townhomes and condos, which cost less than single-family houses. Affordable housing units could also include apartments reserved for people exiting homelessness or those who need supportive service like addiction counseling or job placement. The city has a goal of creating 5,700 new affordable housing units by 2026, and so far has reached 3,910, according to Baldwin. These include 27 new apartments earmarked for people making less than 30% of the area median income, and 100 apartments for people exiting homelessness. These projects and more are funded by an $80 million housing bond passed by voters in 2020. The City Council has also amended the zoning code to allow the construction of townhouses and duplexes in neighborhoods that are traditionally single-family. This year, the council continued its crusade to create housing that is affordable for middle-class residents by allowing the construction of tiny homes, accessory dwelling units, and taller apartment buildings along bus lines. Wake County has also made progress on affordable housing, having set a goal of creating 2,500 new units by 2023. Last year, the county met that goal 2 years ahead of schedule. The new units include apartments, single-family homes, and permanent supportive housing that must stay affordable for the next 30 years. Baldwin said Thursday during her presentation, "I think we can all agree that stable housing is a key to everybody's future. It's key to ending poverty. It's a key to ensuring we have equity in our city. It takes political will to get this done, and people are going to get mad at you. They don't want townhouses in their neighborhood. I've heard people say, I don't want these people living there. I don't know who those people are, but those people are residents of our community, and they deserve a place to live." Still, Raleigh and Wake County have lost many more affordable housing units than they've gained. As of this year, Wake County has, quote, an estimated shortage of 56,000 units affordable to low-income families, according to a county news release. In Raleigh, about 4,700 affordable apartments with rents less than $1,000 a month have been lost on average per year since 2017. Critics of the city council say its zoning policies have made it easier for developers to install high-priced luxury condos and apartment buildings, in some cases wiping out naturally occurring affordable housing. Although more apartments are being built, which helps lower costs, developers are not required to keep rents or mortgages below a certain price. Giving developers more leeway can also lead to gentrification, where property taxes and the cost of living rise, pushing out long-time residents. Ultimately, the consensus is that despite the work the city council is already doing, more work and more money are needed to fight the housing crisis. Growth hasn't just affected the cost of housing, it's spilled over into the job market. When housing is prohibitively expensive, employees can't afford to live near where they work, which can push some low-wage workers to seek jobs elsewhere. That's affected the ability of public bodies to attract qualified job seekers. The Wake County School District, for instance, is having trouble recruiting and retaining employees, said School Board Chair Lindsay Mahaffey during her presentation on Thursday. That's one reason why it raised its minimum wage to $16 an hour this year for non-certified employees such as bus drivers and instructional assistants. Wake County also raised pay for its emergency medical service staff this year, becoming the leader in EMS pay for the state. Starting salaries are now $20 an hour for EMTs and $28 an hour for paramedics. Raleigh also gave employees a 2% cost of living adjustment and raised police and fire pay, though not as high as officers themselves wanted. With so many people coming to Raleigh and Wake County, managing traffic and roadways is another priority for current officials. Baldwin and Hutchinson agreed that moving forward on the commuter rail project, a 37-mile line that goes from Garner to Durham, with stops in Raleigh, Cary, Morrisville, and Research Triangle Park, is on the must-do list. A commuter rail line would help carry people to the Triangle's job centers as well as Raleigh-Durham Airport and college campuses, said Hutchinson. The main challenges to moving this project forward have historically been consensus and cost, Baldwin added. Quote, cost is still a challenge for us right now. The bottom line is that we have to get creative. We can't keep doing things the way we've been doing. We need help from the federal government. We need help from the state. And we also need to have our own commitment to make sure, as leaders, that we are saying, this is necessary. We can't just flinch and go, oh, this is hard. Everything's hard right now. We have to find ways to get it done. Hutchinson touted Apple's move to Raleigh as a big win and had the same victorious attitude towards Amgen's $550 million investment in a new drug manufacturing facility and Fujifilm's Diosynth $2 billion investment in a biologics production plant, both in Holly Springs. The amount of economic growth in Wake County is great news, as companies bring new jobs and boost the tax base, Hutchinson said. But he added, quote, it's only good news if we keep up with the infrastructure, continue to build capacity in housing, continue to build transportation options, continue to invest in our education, and expand Medicaid. We have to continue to do the best because it's nice to be on top, but you can fall off quick. North Carolina is clearly a great place for big business, but what about small businesses and workers? Last year, the state was ranked the worst place to work in America by Oxfam, a nonprofit fighting poverty. Much of that ranking has to do with state laws. The 7.25 minimum wage, bad unemployment benefits, and lack of worker protections. The county and the public school system, the third largest employer in the state, have made some progress on creating living wages for their workers, but many say the pay raises aren't enough. Small businesses are also suffering as they try to keep up with rising real estate costs. In an effort to boost small business, Raleigh officials are offering grants of up to $30,000 for things like debt repayment, equipment or vehicle leasing, specialized training, and technology purchases. The program, which launched last Friday, is funded with $4.2 million in federal money. Where Hutchinson's presentation was overwhelmingly upbeat, Baldwin's was a little more down to earth. She addressed Raleigh's problems frankly, including rising gun violence. So far, there have been 24 homicides in Raleigh this year, compared to 33 total last year. Two men of color have also been gunned down by Raleigh police officers. When it comes to prosecuting violent crime, the city is, quote, getting serious, Baldwin said. In a joint press conference last week, Raleigh Police Chief Estella Patterson announced a new partnership with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Working with federal agents, police have been able to make 27 arrests in the past 3 weeks for allegations involving drugs and guns. Baldwin also spoke about the city's efforts to prevent crime. In the next year, the city aims to educate people about safe gun storage and expand the ACORNS unit. That's a task force that helps people in crisis connect with resources like shelter and counseling. Since the start of this year, Raleigh police officers have intercepted 563 guns in the course of their patrols and received 200 individual reports of guns stolen from cars, said Baldwin. Quote, let that sink in. Most of these cars are unlocked. People are leaving their damn guns in their car where anybody can access them. We are working on an education program, and quite frankly, if you own a gun, I'm begging everybody in this city to be a responsible gun owner. Lock it in a safe. Keep it away from your kids. Keep it away from others. In another effort to prevent crime, the city is working with the NAACP and Moms Demand Action to intervene with people who are at risk of committing or becoming victims of gun violence. Still, some activists are pushing for greater investment in crime prevention. Calls to defund police and refund community programs escalated in June as the city council was passing its annual budget. Council members ultimately ignored a proposal from Refund Raleigh to create an independent crisis response unit and raise pay for city workers in favor of a nearly $8 million funding increase to the Raleigh Police budget. To the Raleigh Police budget. That's an increase of about 7% over last year, mainly in an effort to recruit and retain more officers for patrol and other duties. From Durham, Tomasi McDonald, Dramatics Dispute. Last month, a celebrated, recently retired high school theater arts director filed a petition with the United States Supreme Court to review a labor dispute he has with Durham Public Schools, DPS. Former Hillside High drama teacher Wendell Tabb, who retired this year after an acclaimed Tony Award-winning career spanning more than three decades, filed a petition with the nation's highest court on June the 3rd after the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond and the U.S. Middle District Court in Greensboro both denied his claim that he was forced to work overtime without pay. Tabb also claims that race played a role in DPS refusal to compensate him. In his complaint, he's demanded damages of $40,800 per year. This petition to the Supreme Court is a long shot. According to the Judicial Learning Center, the court agrees to hear less than 1% of the 10,000 cases it receives each year and is most likely to take cases that will affect the entire country, not just the individuals involved. It's a chance that Tab, who is African-American, is willing to take. His petition asked the Supreme Court to determine if race was a factor when DPS refused to compensate him for work he performed, and if the Board of Education's decision was in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when the lower courts denied that Durham School of the Arts drama program was a comparative program to Hillside's theater production. Tab told Indies This Week, "We do just as many plays as Durham School of the Arts, if not more. I'm not trying to bash DSA. The schools are doing an excellent job. This is about equity for all programs. But if I'm having trouble with the level of success I've had, Lord knows what happens to the schools that don't." Tab also asked the Supreme Court to determine if it's ever appropriate for public school officials to negate Fair Labor Standards Act compliance and not pay employees who work overtime. Finally, Tab wants members of a highly politicized conservative court to determine if it is constitutionally equitable for public schools to receive federal funding if the school systems, quote, allow inequalities between employees who perform the same or similar extra duties. In this instance, theater directors and technical theater directors. William Chip Sudderth, the school system's chief communications officer, replied when asked about this petition, "The DPS board does not comment on pending litigation and speaks through its court filings." As the Indian previously reported, the case dates back to 2017 when Tab filed a federal lawsuit against DPS alleging racial discrimination and retaliation. Over more than a decade, he says, he was cheated out of tens of thousands of dollars in unpaid wages. This wasn't merely the result of difficult school funding choices, his lawsuit insists. Tab says he was subjected to payback after he sued the school board in 2006 over the mistreatment of his son, who has cerebral palsy. At the crux of Tab's lawsuit is his claim that, in addition to serving as director of Hillside's drama department, he also functioned as an unofficial, unpaid technical director with a workload that included hanging lights, creating sound designs, and building sets. Two members of a three-judge panel with the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals denied Tab's claim on March 22nd. Judge Paul Niemeyer, writing for the majority, noted that, quote, over the years, Tab had asked the DPS board and Hillside principals to provide him with a theater technical director to relieve him of the hours he has had to devote to technical issues when staging student performances. In making the request, Tab noted that some of the other DPS high schools, quote, had both a theater director and a technical director, and he requested that Hillside High School be one of them. In upholding the U.S. Middle District dismissal, the Fourth Circuit opinion states Tab's desire to create a premier high school theater program was pretty much his own fault. That is, DPS didn't ask him to establish an award-winning, nationally recognized drama program whose students traveled throughout all over the world. Tab made a, quote, independent decision to produce high-quality plays. And while his work was, quote, laudable, it was a decision he made for the benefits of his students rather than a task he performed as a requirement of his position. Fourth Circuit also agreed with the U.S. Middle District ruling that even if the school system's refusal to pay Tab a technical theater director supplement could be considered an adverse action, the retired teacher had not plausibly alleged that DPS had denied him a technical supplement due to his race, because he had not alleged that a single white theater director was paid such a supplement at any time. Niemeyer, whose ruling was joined by Judge Julius Richardson, also agreed with Middle District's decision to exclude DSA as a legitimate comparator for TAB to demonstrate any discrimination, because DSA is a specialized high school for arts and drama, while Hillside offers an international baccalaureate magnet program. TAB's need for a technical director appeared obvious to even the most casual observer of the stage productions he mounted at the historically black high school, one of only four in the state to survive desegregation, along with West Charlotte, E.E. Smith in Fayetteville, and Dudley in Greensboro. In 1995, TAB developed an international professional student exchange program that enabled his budding thespians to study and perform on six continents and all over New York and Los Angeles. He also started a Celebrities in the Classroom program that allowed students to participate in acting workshops with some of the industry's most notable artists. Over the years, Hillside drama students sat at the feet of Danny Glover, Bill Cobbs, Oba Babatunde, Felicia Rashad, and Margaret Shug Avery, the likes of famed choreographer George Faison, and Hillside graduates like fashion icon Andre Leon Talley and the legendary gospel recording artist Shirley Caesar. Along the way, Tab's cultivation of the theater discipline and his nurturing of aspiring artists yielded impressive fruit. His former students include Academy Award-winning film director Kevin Wilson, Jr., actress April Parker Jones, who has a recurring role in the new Peacock drama series Bel Air, Lauren Banks, who plays Siobhan Kays in the Showtime series City on a Hill, and Santron Freeman, a dancer who has worked with Beyoncé, Alicia Keys, and Mariah Carey. Of his 27 complaints, Tab told Indy, it's no coincidence that Hillside's student population is about twice as black as the other schools. About 79% of Hillside students were African American during the 2016 and 17 school year, compared to about 41% at Jordan, 44% at Riverside, and 36% at DSA. Tab's complaint says, despite the success of the Hillside High Drama Program, the school board has failed to provide Hillside High with the same level of staffing and funding that it provides at comparable drama programs in high school that are not predominantly black. He stated he was forced to do the work of two or three teachers in order to maintain the Hillside High Drama Program, while white theater directors at white high schools with comparable programs have had two or more teachers to assist them, according to the Fourth Circuit's majority opinion. Tab, while claiming he has not been compensated for extra duty work, alleges that theater directors with similar programs were not asked to do the same type and volume of unpaid extra work or have been paid an extra duty payment or a contractual payment for performing this type of work. Niemeyer wrote, Tab attributed all of the disparate treatment alleged in his complaint to racial discrimination by the DPS school board. In her dissent, Fourth Circuit Judge Diana Gribben-Motz said the majority erred by dismissing Tab's claim for a financial supplement for his work as Hillside's de facto technical theater director. Motz also noted that in order to allege a civil rights disparate treatment claim, a school employee must plead that his employer, quote, took an adverse action against him, namely, an action that adversely affects the terms, conditions, or benefits of his employment. Tab alleges such an action, Motz stated. He alleges that due to the DPS board's failure to hire a technical director, he regularly needed to perform significant additional work, managing the lighting, sound sets, and other technical duties, to fulfill his own role in directing those productions. Motz would also reverse the U.S. Middle District Court decision to exclude DSA as a comparative program. Once again, DSA Durham School of the Arts, as a comparative program to Hillside Drama. And let's see, Motz wrote, TAB alleges that the drama program at Hillside has become one of the premier high school drama programs in the United States, and that Hillside has produced at least as many, and in most years more, theater productions than DSA. It is thus reasonable to infer that, even though the school district has not specifically labeled Hillside as a drama or arts school, Hillside's drama department would require a similar level of drama staffing at a school that has received such a label. All right, more arts-related news by Lena Geller, again from Durham, Counting Steps. As the war in Ukraine approaches 150 days, global news coverage of the Russian invasion is steadily contracting into a by-the-numbers format, with scorching, unfathomable losses turned cold and quantifiable. Delivered with the caveat that because so many troops have been killed and buried in mass graves along the war's 1,500-mile front line, the death toll is likely much higher than figures suggest. Reporters recite their latest tallies. Tens of thousands of Ukrainian troops and civilians are dead. Millions have been displaced. Thousands of residents, schools, and hospitals have been leveled. Though metrics can be reductive in measuring a war's total impact, we often take solace in the firmness of numbers when a tragedy is as dizzying and indefinite as the war in Ukraine. As some spend their days counting casualties, Christina Dobroshenko, a Ukrainian dance instructor at Durham's Fred Astaire Dance Studio, is counting her steps. When she focuses on the number of beats in a foxtrot or a Viennese waltz or a bachata, she's able to stop thinking about the war devastating her home country. She says the moment you stop counting, the thoughts start to come back into your mind. Dobroshenko is one of a dozen Ukrainian dance instructors at Fred Astaire, a spacious South Durham dance studio with gleaming wood floors, paper lantern-strung ceilings, and walls plastered with posters of its eponymous founder. The Durham studio, owned by local Ukrainian Yuri Simakov, is part of a franchise launched by Astaire in 1947 that now has 180-odd locations across the U.S., Europe, South America, and Africa. Dobroshenko grew up in eastern Ukraine's Luhansk region. She and her husband left the country in 2014 to escape the Russian-Ukraine conflict over Crimea and lived briefly in the United Arab Emirates before moving to Durham, where Simakov, who had taught dance lessons to Dobroshenko's husband years earlier in Ukraine, had offered them jobs at Fred Astaire. Dobroshenko's immediate family resides in an area of Ukraine that has been under Russian occupation for the past 8 years, she says. So while they are pretty safe from violence, they've also been indoctrinated by Russian propaganda. She says no matter how many facts you're going to tell them, no matter how many videos and news articles you're going to show them, it's really hard for them to believe what's going on. The war has had a greater impact on her husband's parents, she says, who recently fled their home in Severodvinsk and moved to a port city in southern Ukraine, bearing no belongings except a little purse containing their passports and a bottle of water. During the past few months, several Fred Astaire instructors have managed to get their families out of Ukraine. Simakov, for one, moved his parents to Durham in March, and his mother's home-cooked cutlets and mashed potatoes have been a welcome comfort for the staff. But Dovroshenko's father-in-law is younger than 60 years old, and Ukrainian men aged 18 to 60 are banned from leaving the country. There's nothing that she and her husband can do to ensure his parents' safety. Those are the things that Dobroshenko forgets about when she counts her steps. It takes your mind away, she says. When you dance, you don't think about anything. And when she's not dancing, Dobroshenko finds consolation in her fellow instructors, most of whom are enduring similar challenges. Natalia, an instructor who moved from Kyiv to Durham 2 years ago and asked to be identified by only her first name. Says her family has been struggling since 2014 when they lost everything they owned during a Russian bombing attack. The same year, Ukraine enacted a law requiring residents living in separatist-controlled parts of eastern Ukraine, including the Donetsk region, where Natalia's parents reside, to physically cross the border into government-controlled areas every 60 days in order to receive their pension. For the past 8 years, Natalia's parents have been making the exhausting 450-mile trek from Donetsk to Kiev every 2 months. But with Donetsk now under relentless bombardment from Russian forces, her parents' most recent journey to Kiev has turned into an indefinite relocation. Like Dovrushenko's husband, Natalia is unable to retrieve her parents because her father is under 60, but she talks to them on the phone every day. On some nights, Natalia says her mother has to hide under a blanket while reading the news on her phone, so that the light of the screen doesn't attract the attention of nearby artillery. It's a new part of surviving, says Natalia. At Fred Astaire, Natalia has found a supportive community in not just her co-workers, but her students who bring her flowers and regularly text her to share prayers for her family. And when she's dancing in the studio, she says she's able to remember the pleasure of life. She says you can feel the different time in different melodies. Natalia may be referencing the rhythms and time signatures that vary from dance to dance, the kind that Dobroshenko loses herself in. But I get the feeling that she's looking at time through a broader lens. Certain melodies remind her of a time before the war, or allow her to envision a time that's yet to come. Natalia says, dancing distracts us in a good sense. You're full of negative emotion, and dancing helps us to feel something better, to believe in the good future. And another column from Durham by Savannah Wen called Food Fair. Browning banana peels, decaying fish bones, crumbling pizza crusts. These ingredients may not seem appetizing to most, but to seedlings hungry for fertile soil, they're the stuff of a gourmet meal. A city food waste collection program in the Walltown neighborhood has redirected more than 4.5 tons of waste from landfills since it launched just 6 months ago. Through a curbside pickup system, the pilot program processes food scraps from 80 Walltown households and returns them to the environment as rich compost. Every Thursday evening, small black carts line the streets of Walltown. One of these belongs to Hafiz Dalla and his partner, Karina Barnett-Loro, who joined the program when recruitment efforts began in late 2021. Neighbors often inquire about the container, they said. Barnett Loro, sitting on her back porch, which overlooks her fruitful garden, says, "Actually, a lot of people have come up to us and said, 'Oh, what's that? I haven't seen it before.'" Some of those neighbors, she said, have since signed up. He's eager to make their neighborhood a greener place. The program represents a collaboration between the city, a local company, and Duke researchers. The city collects the food waste and delivers it to Atlas Organics, a company that converts the scraps to compost. This final product is sold to gardeners and landscapers and also distributed for free at occasional public giveaway events, such as a June 11th compost giveaway at Briggs Avenue Community Garden. The city will work with Atlas Organics to host another event in the fall. Melissa Southern, who first began composting in 2019 to nourish her garden beds, was also excited to see the project serve her community. She said, "It seems that Walltown does not typically get picked for these kind of pilots. I love that our neighborhood was chosen, and to see it do so well and so many people participate is really, it's encouraging." Southern lives in Walltown with her husband and one-year-old and has seen her household's garbage output shrink to just a third of what it once was. She said, "We went from maybe 3 trash bags a week or 2 trash bags to 1 a week, and I think that's really impressive." The pilot program was originally intended to run for just 12 weeks, according to Wayne Fenton, the city's assistant director of solid waste. But when the trial period was up, all participants opted to continue curbside food waste collection. The environmental benefits of composting extend beyond improving soil health and conserving water. By keeping food waste out of landfills, composting helps curb methane emissions that contribute heavily to global warming. Nevertheless, some deterrents keep people from taking up for practice. For instance, the odor. Dalla recalled a recent party he and Barnett Laurel hosted in which composting played a role. "We had a party here not that long ago, and we all got compostable plates and cups and stuff and thought it'd be great if everyone just put their stuff in the compost. And it was, I don't think we anticipated just how stinky the bin had gotten over time. But, you know, we hosed it out, and it was fine." Despite this mild hiccup, the couple has enjoyed their experience. Dallas says, "We love the program. We'd love for it to get expanded for all of Durham." To run smoothly, the program relies on psychology as much as earth science. In order to motivate and sustain the habit of composting, the city collaborates with the Duke Center for Advanced Hindsight. That's a great name. The Duke Center for Advanced Hindsight. To formulate strategies and messaging, the city issued countertop food waste collection bins with acceptable items illustrated clearly on the front and also encouraged participants to download the Durham Rollout app, which sends weekly reminders about food waste pickup days. Lindsay Gavin, innovation project manager for the city, says programs such as the Walltown pilot may encourage environmentally friendly behaviors in other areas of life and foster engagement with one's community. She said, "Does collection of your food scraps in the morning make you think about turning your thermostat down or reducing your water use or some other kind of pro-environmental behaviors that we would consider spillover from participating in this?" And then, beyond environmentalism, this is a city-run municipal service that's being brought to you. So does that also make you think more about belonging to your community or engagement with your local government? Project leaders are currently scouting out a new candidate area for phase 2 of the project, which is expected to kick off in mid-August. The second phase will reach roughly 500 households, in addition to the 80 still receiving service in Walltown. In this phase, researchers from the city and the Duke Center will analyze how much waste is diverted from landfill. They will also assess whether behavioral interventions reduce contaminations of the compost, and will conduct surveys and interviews to gauge participants' attitude toward the program. Barnett Loro is optimistic that her vegetable peelings and coffee grounds are making a difference. Quote, "I think it is, from a behavioral change standpoint, one of those daily reminders of, you know, this is the kind of impact that I'm having." And finally, little time exists for me to read an entire article about building musical bridges, but it's very intriguing. Larry Bellerin and Joe Troop blend música llanera and bluegrass into an egalitarian Nuevo South brew. Lofty quotes about music litter the philosophical record. Confucius and Plato both weighed in, writes Nick McGregor, although their respective aphorisms, "music provides a kind of pleasure which human nature cannot do without," and "music is a moral law," are impossible to definitively attribute. Easier to source is Arthur Schopenhauer's famous 19th century claim that music is the language of feeling and of passion. But cantankerous English art critic John Berger might have said it best in 2015. A song narrates a past experience. While it is being sung, it feels the present, while it hopes to reach a listening ear in some future somewhere. It leans forward farther and farther. That spirit of propulsive, progressive momentum is alive in the work of Larry and Joe. Born in Winston-Salem and now based in Durham, Joe Troop learned bluegrass and old-time music as a teenager before spending a decade living in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and leading Grammy-nominated fusion group Che Apalache. Larry Bellerin, meanwhile, grew up 2,100 miles south in Punta de Mata, Monagas, Venezuela, where he was a legend of música llanero. That's traditional Venezuelan music punctuated by arpa, that's a harp, cuatro, small classical guitar, and maracas, hand percussion. Forced into exile 6 years ago by the Venezuelan migration crisis, Bellerin applied for political asylum and landed in Raleigh, where he started working construction while rebuilding his musical life. The unlikely duo connected at the beginning of 2022 with help from Sofia Enriquez, an assistant professor at Duke specializing in the intersection of Latinx and Appalachian music, migration, and belonging. Bellerin had accompanied Enriquez during a gig at the North Carolina Museum of Art while Troop was gearing up for a month-long residency at Durham Fruit. Troop tells Indie Week, Larry came to the first gig and joined in on bass. Then I sent him some scratch recordings to learn before the next show. When he took out his harp, he got a standing ovation. Bellerin, who responds in Spanish, effortlessly translated by bilingual Troop, smiles and adds, right away, there was something really unique between us, a different kind of connection. That connection is built on the surprising common ground that exists between Bellerin's música llanera tradition and Troop's bluegrass heritage. They're both the folkloric representations of our country, Bellerin says. They're both string band music and they're both working class music. Having that commonality, but from different vantage points, is what gives us our own unique identity. Well, I'm sorry to have to curtail that, and we'll have to go to indieweek.com if you'd like to read that entire review of this concert or album. So, John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.org, will say farewell to you for this edition of the Independent Indie Week, indieweek.com. Have a good week, and we'll be with you for the next issue. Bye-bye.